I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
This is What's Next, and we're celebrating Pride Month over here. I'm Thomas O'Neill White, and joining me today is community advocate Alex Burgos and Tajay Jenkins-Jones, the CEO, president, and chairman of Upstate New York Black and Latino Pride. Thank you both for being on with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
We are in the month of June, and June is Pride Month. Alex and Tajay, I would love to get your opinions on the historical significance of Pride Month, how it started, and what it means to both of you. Alex, we'll start with you.
Well, Pride Month in the United States was founded in commemoration to the Stonewall riots that happened in New York City. And that's oftentimes why you see people expressing and reclaiming the quote that the first Pride was a riot, even in modern day parades and festivals, because that is quite literally historically accurate in the U.S. But Pride, the way that we see it in modern times and the way that it's evolved into being a community-wide demonstration is only one culmination of what it is for this era. But the sense of pride and LGBT expression and the LGBT spirit has been around since the beginning of time and can be dated back even to ancient Egyptian times. They just had different words and an understanding of what it meant to be a queer person at that time. And so Pride as a month is, I suppose, our era and our age's culmination of what that expression of human life is.
Tajay?
Yeah, and to Alex's point, so Stonewall is the catalyst that gets us to making this like a full-blown movement. But, you know, there had been so many other uprisings leading up to Stonewall, you know, that combined with the fairly recent decriminalization of homosexuality, things like that had started to melt down a bit. And when we saw folks gravitating to New York City, to California, to more progressive areas, you know, places that were a little bit safer because they could find community to help protect each other, we see people start to have what we call now pride in the identity because they were able to be affirmed by people like them in those spaces. So when we saw things like police brutality coming into play, like we've seen in every civil rights movement, right? Police brutality, the overusage of police is always used to marginalize folks and criminalize identities. In those moments, people decided to uprise, and it wasn't a calculated moment. You know, it was, as Alex said, it was a culmination of a lot of different things that pushed people to say, we're not going to keep getting pushed around. And I think one of the little known facts that we don't talk about enough with Pride Week is that it was not just queer people. You know, there were straight allies. There were Black Panthers supporting. Huey P. Newton actually sent out a newsletter to all of the Black Panther sectors throughout the country saying that we need to think about what it means to support other marginalized people. If we're all being oppressed by the same oppressor, it makes no sense for us to be divisive.
Now, is that where you see parallels between the civil rights movement from even like 20 years prior to Stonewall and the modern LGBTQ plus movement?
I think that, take for example, the old cliche, right, of saying divide and conquer. Mm-hmm. That's always the case. It's always the case. So if you marginalize people indiscriminately, but then you get them to wage war against each other, people can never connect the dots, you know? And I think that exactly what you're asking me right now makes me think of Fred Hampton and what he was able to do in Chicago, right? He went to the former sharecroppers who were Klansmen, who were Nazis, you know, and said to them, we have the same oppressor, right? We're not the reason that you guys are not winning in society, but the reason that we're all not winning is the same reason. in those beginning conversations, those uncomfortable conversations, were the reason that we were able to move the dial forward. And to some degrees, you know, I think it's still divisive now because obviously there's that same kind of conflict has risen back in this era.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a completely different thing. But I'm saying at this particular moment, when we talk about being holistic in our approach, you have to understand the intersectionality of it all in order to move things forward. And I think that's absolutely a parallel, because the civil rights movement would not have progressed forward without the allyship that was able to get access to certain things and able to support in ways that others couldn't.
So we kicked off Pride Month a little early this year.
Mm-hmm.
This Gag City event that was put together on Bidwell Parkway. Tell us a bit about this event.
So the Gag City Outdoor Vogue Night and Pride Kickoff is really just a way to bring the community together on that Friday of Pride. That Friday of Pride weekend tends to be the day where everyone does their parties, where all the different segments of the LGBT community have their, you know, their thing dedicated to them. And I mean, for me, it was really important that LGBT people of color have a space that is designed by and for them. And, you know, for myself, those are the spaces where I found liberation. Those are the spaces where I found acceptance. Those are the spaces where I was able to grow and thrive. And so now someone that's on the other side of a coming out story or of, you know, LGBT experience, it's important to me to give the next set of people the same opportunities and if not better opportunities than what I had coming up. So I had the idea of doing the Outdoor Vogue Night on Elmwood and Breckenridge, right in the heart of, you know, not only a very LGBT-friendly neighborhood, but a neighborhood that its backbone is built on arts and cultures.
Mm-hmm.
That is, in many ways, the linchpin between many diverse neighborhoods. No matter what direction you go to, when you start on Elmwood and Breckenridge, you know, that is the epicenter of a lot of different cultures. Whether you go on the West Side, you have the New American community, you have a lot of the Hispanic community, you have a very diverse population as well on the East Side. And so it's bringing everyone across the city together. You know, people competed across four different ballroom categories, all inspired by Nicki Minaj's latest album, Pink Friday 2. Four cash prizes and trophies, you know, there were also community resources there available. You know, it's incredibly important to me that when we're hosting these spaces that we be intentional. So everyone comes, they have a really great time, but there's an empowerment aspect to it as well, right? So people are coming in, they may come in for the event, but they may get connected to healthcare. They may get connected to health insurance. They may get connected to rental assistance or other programs that historically high distress communities need. So, you know, while we were celebrating the art of ballroom during Pride weekend, I think the overall goal really is to create more spaces where health and community exist in equal parts.
Do you want to add to that, Tajay?
Sure. And just to even give it a bit of history, too, you know, we started carving these kind of spaces out years ago before we started Upstate New York when we were at Mocha. You know, we have Mocha Buffalo under Trillium Health. You know, we did block parties. And the idea that came about was to subvert the idea of what a health fair looks like, right? Mm-hmm. It's not to say that the event was a health fair, but to some degree it was a health fair, you know, because we had not every possible, but, you know, a plethora of different healthcare resources in the space. We had testing that was taking place, testing that was incentivized, you know, with free tickets to Pride for the first 10 people, right? We had elected officials who were there that were able to see the people that they represent and see how big the queer community is, and specifically the POC queer community, because we don't always get a lot of time to make those people visible. Mm-hmm. So the reason for any space that we carve out, you know, Gag City being one that at this point we're, you know, I think we're in our masterclass era for, we've done things similar to this in the past. You know, that is an event that follows that model that we take to anything that we do. It's always bringing the community resources while entertaining and giving them a space.
Is Gag City something that will be an annual event moving forward?
Yes, but Gag City was the theme of this event. The actual event is the Outdoor Vogue Night, so people have to stay tuned for next year's theme, but I'm already cooking it up in my head.
Oh,
so.
All right. Mm-hmm. All right. Tajay, you mentioned off air, you know, the different segments of the community, of the LGBTQ community coming together. Can you get a little more into that? Just having you know, you said there's the ballroom, there's kind of like the social groups and just the myriad of groups that make up the community and how they interact and how they respond to things. Can you get a little more in depth into that conversation?
Sure. So I think that what's important when you talk like DEI, right, if you want to make it kind of procedural, but when you talk DEI in any capacity, it's important to understand the intersectional identities, right? So that means taking a moment to say, what makes up this larger body, right? Because the biggest thing that we hear often is this community or this identity is not a monolith, or this identity is not a monolith, right? And the only way to really break apart the idea that we are a monolith, or that there's one way to be queer, or that there's one way to show pride, is by everyone having a seat at the table, right? So when we talk about queer history in general, you have to talk about all the different factors that make that up, right? So when we talk about, and I think it's what's the thing that's so interesting when we talk about like LGBTQ history, and like we talk about the things that I'm about to jump into, is that I think that to other communities, it's often seen as superficial, right? So a drag show, for example, or a pageant, or a ball, right? It's nightlife. Yes, it's nightlife, but in many instances, it's the only opportunity that people are able to see each other, socialize, politic in a space where they feel safe and where they feel they can be authentic,
right?
So that awe plays into how we progress socially, right? Because if you're talking about hosting a pageant, for example, and it's a pageant that is historically racist, you know what I mean? Maybe they pick over queens of color that may have deserved to win, or like maybe the crowd felt deserved to win, or maybe it's something that's done quite often, right? Which it was the catalyst to ballroom when Crystal LaBeija went through that same situation during the pageant that's displayed in the documentary The Queen. You know, there's this moment at the end where she kind of just goes into a number about like, I didn't come here to be picked over by someone who was unprepared and this and this and this, right? Mm-hmm. And when it's definitive where people can say and see it didn't make sense that this happened, the injustice has become clear. If you see that done over and over and over and over and over and over and over, that space becomes exclusionary because people are saying, well, the people that I'm coming to support aren't there. You know what I mean? It disconnects us as a community. Mm-hmm. So I say that to say, if we look at every single space and we talk about how they directly affect the social progression of our community, intentionality like that is important to be able to say, I have this whole community of people who all love drag, who all love pageantry, who feel comfortable in this space, who want to pour into it, who want to keep the legacy alive. And they also feel like they actually have an opportunity to win and compete and be a part of it. It does nothing but build our community up, right? It puts people in spaces with diverse identities. It progresses us as a society. So I say that to say, if we take that approach to every space that we carve out, be they social, be they political, be they societal, and we make sure that everyone has a seat at the table in some capacity, we do nothing but progress the community forward. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, so that was absolutely. Big. You also mentioned off air about queer history in Western New York.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very prominent. And there's a database that kind of collects.
There's two. And forgive me for not remembering the name of either, but they're both housed at our two largest universities. So Buff State has the largest queer archives in Western New York.
Bengal Pride, baby.
And then UB also has a pretty sizable queer archive, including, I can't think of it. Oh, I wish I would have done a little research before this. There was a queer radio station that was hosted at UB in the 70s that is,
wow.
The audio is actually archived at UB. So those are kind of things that you can look through and learn more. There's an organization that I also mentioned, the Buffalo Niagara LGBTQ History Project, that contributes to both of those archives on a regular basis and also does things like fundraise to create historical markers for queer moments that are distinctive and make a difference in Western New York history, you know? But we have a lot of it. There's so much of it, you know? I think even dating back to the early 1900s.
Is there any story or news item that you find interesting related to queer history in Western New York?
I'll give you one. And it's not a beginning, middle, end, but it's just a space that I've heard stories about, I've researched personally, and I've met people who actually were in the space. But there was a hotel / bar called Little Harlem on Michigan Ave that was a historically black space, and it was queer inclusive. Right? It's known for being queer inclusive. And this was a space that black queer people, black straight people could come to, but there was also this intersection of like celebrities that would come through the space. So it was one of the only hotels that black people could stay in Buffalo at the time. So you'd see folks coming in, you know, of huge statures like Lena Horne's and people of that nature. A friend of mine, Foster Williams, actually, I got a whole deep dive about just that space. But knowing that in the early 1900s, you know, this is like pre-Stonewall stuff. We're having a space like that in Buffalo. I've always thought that was interesting because there's this idea that LGBTQ people and like cishet people can't be in a space together and be comfortable. And I think that this generation is now bringing back the idea that those spaces can be carved out and everyone can feel comfortable and safe.
And that actually brings me to my next question. Where are we as a society on queer issues? Are we continuing to progress? Where have we taken steps back, maybe in policy, and where can we improve?
I think that progress overall from where we were 100 years ago, we've progressed, right? But progress is not linear and it's not a straight path up. Unfortunately, you know, whenever we are trying to push for progress or we are being our most authentic selves, that invokes fear in a lot of people, right? Because when we're our most authentic selves, when we're out and open and proud, we're also our most powerful selves. And that takes away power from people who are beneficiaries to us just being shoved back into the closet. And so I think what you're seeing right now, and I'll actually bring a stat, is that last year was one of the worst years for anti-LGBT policy in the U.S., according to the Human Rights Campaign. Wow. And they actually issued a state of emergency on LGBT policies and even have some travel ban advisories for some states in our own country. We are in the same country, and yet some other states, like Florida, for example, are operating completely differently than we do here in New York. And so I need people to understand that while New York is often seen as a progressive state and a safe haven, we can't be complacent. You know, you see that the rise in anti-LGBT rhetoric and right-wing extremism spreads everywhere. And that base is unfortunately very unified. And when they have messaging, everyone falls for it and they believe in it. And so I need people to understand the power that they have in not only being their most authentic selves, but also taking that authenticity and putting it at the polling place and using their voice and registering people to vote and mobilizing and getting involved in policy work or advocacy, because there's too much to lose and nothing gets done when we sit around. And unfortunately, at this point, we're not in a place in our community where we can feel comfortable just yet.
You feel the same way, Tajay?
Absolutely. I think that even like to Alex's point of when we talk about New York and New York being a bit of a haven for queer people, right? That's still predicated on the idea that you're in a big city, right? We talk Buffalo, we talk Rochester, we talk New York City, Albany, Syracuse even, right? There's a lot of like queer people that are being able to progress. It's slightly comfortable, right? But how many cities and towns are actually in New York State when you consider that that's maybe 5 or 6? I didn't count the names that I shouted out. But you know, so like you go 45 minutes in either direction in any of these areas and queer people are not feeling safe. They're not feeling supported. And although they can drive 30 minutes up the road to a bigger city that might be a bit inclusive where they are, it's not always the safest place. So to Alex's point, Buffalo's doing great work with our queer community, but that's historical. That's not new. You know what I mean? Every community in America, and I don't even want to go state by state. Let's go city by city. Every city in America that is queer inclusive and safe for LGBTQ people have had people organizing and doing the work to make those spaces that way for the last 50 to 100 years. So at no point can we sit back and say, oh, look how progressive we are in Buffalo. You know, we got our first this or our first gay that or our first lesbian this. And then you go an hour out to Jamestown and these people are doing anything they can to get to Buffalo to feel safe and comfortable and queer for a weekend.
Right. So how do you create like a coalition or that community that's obviously Buffalo?
Yeah.
It's Rochester. It's Syracuse. But it's also like Jamestown. It's also maybe North Tonawanda. It's also these smaller cities and these smaller towns across the state to make sure those people who do feel unsafe where they rest their head can feel safer in their towns.
I think that coalition is called Upstate New York Black and Latino Pride.
Let's get into it.
Seriously. And it's funny because I was going to say something exactly what Alex said, but in a different way. But I think that if you look at the Black and Latino queer communities in Western New York and in Upstate New York, we're significantly more connected to each other than the other like pocket queer communities or more like, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? So that's not something that's born out of like organization. It's something that's born out of necessity because it says like, oh my gosh, there's no club here in Buffalo that we can go to that we feel safe and inclusive in this at. Someone in this city is doing a party this weekend, so we need to know about that so we can go have those social exchanges, right? Because that's fair. Mm-hmm. And those moments become like, okay, guys, we got this happening, this happening, this happening, but we should have this, 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 and this happening. And we need this, and our community needs that. And what about these resources? What about testing? We're doing this stuff not because we woke up one day and we're like, let's organize. All of it's born out of necessity. So the coalition is multifaceted, right? Because right. You have these people doing this organizing that are outreaching. You go to Syracuse and you think of a person like Sparkle, for example. Sparkle's not just reaching out to people in the middle of Syracuse. You know, Syracuse is actually kind of large when you look at how connected it is to Central New York. They're doing that outreach to get those folks in from those spaces too. So I think the organizers are doing what they can, but it's a capacity issue. It's a resource issue. And I say it's multifaceted because we're on the ground doing the work. We're seeing people on the ground doing the work. And at this point, we're in the middle, but also still on the ground, right? We're medium sized, maybe not tiny, mm-hmm. but a lot of other folks are one person that are just saying, hey, let me try to bring these resources in this community to our folks. So I say that the folks at the top, the folks who are deciding where funding goes, the larger affinity groups that are looking for people, the people are looking for you guys too.
Where do you see growth in your organization and where do you see Upstate New York Black and Latino Pride in the next 3 years?
The work we're doing in Buffalo is going to continue, but it's going to expand, right? And what that expansion looks like is us continuing to bring the necessary resources to our community. And that's more than just one thing, if that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't have a crystal ball, but the idea is to bring vital resources to this community here and then support other communities throughout Upstate New York in doing those same kind of things. What that looks like is going to be different. And I think that the mistake a lot of people make is finding one blanket approach to pass out to a bunch of different communities. Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, Albany, New York City, Georgetown, all of the different places that we have in New York State are different. So you have to take a different approach to all of them. But our idea is to continue to be the conduit to our community's elevation and upward mobility.
What about being an ally? How can someone support the queer community without centering themselves in that support or in those conversations? Because it can be tough with well-meaning people, but you know they put themselves in the conversation when they should be more so listening and observing.
I think it just comes down to a question people have to ask is how can I help or how can I support? That's it. You know, that's really the biggest thing. And then from there, allow that to be the guiding force of allyship, you know, and then asking people what that support looks like, right? Sometimes that support looks like volunteerism. Maybe you need an extra set of hands to help out with something. Sometimes that looks like media exposure and giving someone that platform, you know, to advocate for their community and be a representative. Sometimes, you know, especially in our generation, sometimes that is financial empowerment. Sometimes you need to support the work that organizers are doing financially, whether it be, you know, to give them an opportunity for themselves to be paid or for their organization to have funding to do this work, or whether it be to fund a project or to give them a grant or so forth, I think one of the biggest barriers to our community having continued capacity to have meaningful resources is that a lot of our young people especially can't make a livelihood out of this work. And oftentimes what you see is it creates and perpetuates this cycle of burnout and eventually leads to resources dying altogether. So, you know, even one of the things we've done as an organization and that I've been very intentional about is I think basically everybody that does any kind of volunteerism or work for us is paid. I can't think of anyone that was ever an unpaid volunteer. I can't. Maybe, you know, if someone was a sponsor and they wanted to help out with like passing out tote bags or something, but all of the youth that you see setting up at the festival or helping us out, they're getting paid. And part of it is because I hold the belief that all labor holds value.
Mm-hmm.
And I hold the belief that in order to keep young people motivated and in this movement, they shouldn't have to decide between paying rent and doing something for their community.
Tajay, how do you feel about that?
I think innovation is the biggest thing. And a lot of times when people hear resources, they see dollar signs, right? They hear like, oh, okay, how much do you want me to, how big is the check need to be? And I think that is important. But when you talk about the value of saying, hey, I see you guys have an upcoming event and we have a giant, not field, but like a giant parking lot next door to us. So we would like to offer you this space to host this. And, you know, you won't have to worry about electrical needs, bathroom usage. Maybe we can sponsor food or water or something along those lines. So it's not always about how much funding a person can give us or an organization or a particular space when you talk about allyship. Sometimes it's about, like Alex said, saying, what do you need? How can I be of service? And I think especially folks that are at the top of their careers sometimes don't think about how valuable of a resource they can be, because sometimes advice is just as valuable as financial resources. Sometimes saying, I would like to mentor a person. Can you help connect me with someone within the LGBTQ community? Because I want to see more people have access to this. Those are just as valuable as a $1,000 check from an organization. They're just as valuable as the volunteer work that we get. It's really saying, how can I be a partner to you guys? Maybe it's hosting financial literacy classes like we just talked about. You know, maybe it's offering education that folks will have to pay for otherwise.
This is What's Next, where we have been discussing Pride Month. I want to thank my guests, Alex Burgos and Tajay Jenkins-Jones from Upstate Black and Latino Pride. I want to thank you both for being with us today. We'll be back with more What's Next after this.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Welcome to What's Next. I'm Jay Moran. Last year on What's Next, right around this time of the year, we had a local team, a team of local poets who were getting ready to travel down to the Southern Fried Poetry Slam. Last year, I believe it was in Tennessee. This year, it's in Florida. Well, we don't have the whole team coming in, but we do have a team member from the Southern Fried Poetry Slam team from Buffalo. He happens to be one of my teammates, Dallas Taylor here at WBFO. Dallas, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Jay. I'm excited to talk about the Poetry Slam and just poetry in general. It's going to be a really good time. We're going down to Pompano Beach. Mm. It's going to be a nice time on the beach. It's nice here in Buffalo right now, but it'll be even nicer down in Florida. So looking forward to that.
You might like it hot because you're going here in the middle of June. So it's hot enough for me right here in Buffalo right now anyway. But hey, just let's go through it. So slam poetry. Give us just an idea of what slam poetry, what that means.
So slam poetry is it's a competition based, and I believe it started out in Chicago. I don't have the full history on it, but essentially I'm going to take you through a poetry slam really quick. So say there's maybe 6 or 7 poets.
Okay.
We'll all draw an order, like, all right, you go this order, that, that, and that. It starts with 2 rounds, so you usually have 2 poems ready to go.
Oh, okay.
So we'll go in an order. First round, that order. Second round, reverse the order. Now, how you're judged by a random group of judges that are picked out from the audience.
Okay.
From people observing, because poetry is subjective and, you know, you can just pick random people out there and...
So it's not a group of experts, it's a group of just people who are enjoying the
yes,
what you're doing.
People enjoying the venue, enjoying the poetry, and once they get the scorecard in their hand to become a judge, they are now the expert.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
So your poem, you are trying to impress them, but also you're trying to tell them your story. Because this may be the first and last time that they hear that poem, the first and last time that they hear your story. So when we're going up there, we are giving it our all, we're telling our truth, and we're putting our full emotion and body into it. And for a lot of, they call them slam poets, it's a lot of performance. Because, you know, if you're just reading a poem to a judge, now you just have the words and you can appreciate the words, but if you can put some life into it, that's where you can really find like the real true essence of the poem.
Okay.
So when you see a slam poet, when you talk about slam poems or a slam poet, that's a person who is, it's a very performative poem. Like there's maybe some theater aspect to it as right. well. And you know, there's more emphasis on the words. There is very much volume as terms of loudness, but you can also take it on the down part and be a little bit more reserved and quiet. You can, as one of our teammates, Brandon, said, you can either burst into the room or you can get on stage and just suck the air out of the room.
Okay. All right. Now, so how did you make your way onto this Buffalo team? Like I mentioned at the top, we had the Buffalo team that went down to Tennessee last year. Now you're on the team. It was pretty easy to find you because your desk is literally 2 seats away from mine. How did you make this team?
So throughout the season or throughout the year, hearing poetry, local poetry community here in Buffalo, they host poetry slams throughout the season, throughout the year. And if you participate in these slams and you place, then you acquire points. And throughout the season, you acquire these points. And by the end of the season, top 3 or top 4, you now qualify to become part of the Pure Ink Poetry team that is going to go down to the Southern Fried Poetry Slam. So it really all started a year ago where I've always written poetry.
Right.
And I would just write it like, this is corny little love poem, you know, for the person that I'm never going to give it to. And now I just write it and now I'm never going to see it. They're never going to see it. And it's just gone away.
Okay.
I have a lot of stuff like that. But about a year ago, I was just at home at night with my cat watching some rap battles on YouTube.
Okay.
And you can get to a rabbit hole watching that stuff.
Okay. All right. Right. Right.
And the next day, I was in my cubicle. I was working. Of course, I was working.
As you always are.
And I saw a post.
Hardest working guy in show business. Yeah, okay.
Saw a post on Washington Post that said, TSA has declared peanut butter a liquid. And I was like, huh, interesting.
All right.
And I wrote it down in my notes because I usually just do that, just write a random thing down in my notes, something that I found interesting.
Okay.
But this one particular moment, I wrote that down and I just kept writing.
Oh.
But it was in the form of almost like a battle rap. And it was really fun to just get into my head and find that creative writing process that I've always had, but hadn't really had a chance to tap into it.
All right.
And there I had this thing created. And maybe about a day later, I saw that Hearing Poetry was having a poetry slam. And I'm like, well, I've got this thing, and now this poetry slam, I have to go in and do it.
Okay.
And I read that you had to have two poems. Like, all right, well, then let me write another one.
All right.
And I kind of wrote that in the same kind of vein. And then I went to this poetry slam, and it was my first ever poetry slam. And I placed second.
Whoa.
I was like, all right, well, I got to keep doing this now, because now I want to win one.
Right.
I've gotten this close on my first try. So, and then that was my first poetry slam. And after a while, I kept going to them, and people kept telling me, hey, you're pretty good. And also you're placing in some of these and you're acquiring points. If you do a couple more and place a little bit higher, then you could be on our team to go down to the Southern Fried Poetry Slam.
Wow. Okay.
So at that point I was locked in. I was like, all right, well then.
There was a prize, and you liked the process.
Yeah.
So we're going to start off then, we're already well into our conversation, obviously, but we want to hear Peanut Butter. So I'm just before we get you started, I'm going to turn down your mic a little bit. You've kind of warned me that maybe this might get a little loud. I should also put the disclaimer in there that Dallas is traditionally one of the quietest people here at a very loud place, WBFO. So I'll let you go from here. Go ahead.
TSA has declared peanut butter a liquid. That is not true. First of all, if you're bringing peanut butter to the airport, what's the matter with you? Well, now let's get to the task at hand. TSA has come up with this grand idea that peanut butter is a liquid. Well, here's the thing, kids. I've been eating peanut butter since I was a kid, and one thing that I never did was pour Peter Pan into a yellow lid, but I was more of a Jif person myself. Every time I reach up on the shelf for the clear, or is it brown, jar for the product that enhanced my sandwiches for the betterment of my health, never once did I spill, because I got it like that. And then I spread it so good, and I flip it on its back. See, I don't just talk about it, I am about it. But if you tell me peanut butter is a liquid, well then yeah, I doubt it, but let's talk about it. Peanut butter is butter, right? Let's start there and leave the rest out of sight. We have butter, but then there's liquid butter. They can't be the same. If they were the same, why would they have a different name? These are the things that make me is ice water? Yes or no? If you say no, I'd agree, but if you say yes, how so? Its contents are the same, but its states of being are different. It's like you and your boyfriend love each other, but he's afraid of commitment. Your contents are the same, but your states of being are different. When I mess up, it's a problem, but when you mess up, it's an accident. Our contents are the same, but our states of being are different. I admit to my mistakes, but you always say, no, I didn't. You see how two things can be the same, but totally different at the same time? I can see how things get blurry, so let me make a clear line. There is nothing butter. It is not liquid. Dallas, slow down. They may have missed it. I said there is nothing but her. It is not liquid. And if I didn't tell her, that's something I couldn't live with. She's difficult when she's cold, but she is smooth when she's hot. And she fits with just about everything, no matter how little I've got. She makes everything lively and richer to taste, and I want every drop of her, let nothing go to waste. She's a different kind of flavor, one you don't get in the store, so once you use her all up, you don't get her no more, so I savor every solid moment, because solid is what this is. And don't ever tell me that peanut butter is a liquid. Poem.
Wow, that was something. And I also was fortunate enough I got to see your facial expressions, but I like to think that came through for sure on our recording here. So you say Pure Ink put together the first slam poet event, and Pure Ink is involved in forming the team that's going to Southern Fried?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So Brandon Williamson, he's the head of Pure Ink Poetry, hosts quite a few slams throughout the year, whether it's at Ujima, whether it's at outside on Bidwell Park in front of Cafe Aroma, at Days Park Tavern over on Allen, just a couple of different places. A lot of poets come through and just show their stuff, and it's a really good time. And those who kind of keep going in place, then they get qualified for the team to go down there to Florida, for this year going down to Florida. So
yeah
it's a really good time.
So it is a team event, and you're going with the team. So let's talk about your team just a little bit. We've heard a little bit about your story. What can you tell us about the strengths and what some of your teammates bring to the game?
So this will be my first time going down there. It'll also be another one of my teammates' first down, Jamila. She is a great writer, and her poems are, they're sneaky impactful.
Hmm.
Like, she doesn't come with a lot of the boisterous energy like some of our other teammates, but still, if you're listening to the words and you can kind of feel the emotion of them, then you will still feel the impact. So she is great there, where it's like her poems won't really punch you in the face, but they may slap you a little bit. Like, oh, I wasn't expecting that.
Okay. All right. Very good.
On the other end is JB, JB Stone or Jared. He's the amplifier of the team. He is the loudest of all of us, and he has the most infectious energy where you will know he is there. You will know okay. when he's coming. And when he's giving his poetry, he is very much, you will definitely hear him from a ways away, but his poems are very, he's telling his truth about who he is and how he grew up and just how his personality is very much a part of who he is and how he's not going to shy away from that. So his poems definitely come with a punch.
Okay.
Another teammate of ours is kind of on that same level is Janelle.
Hmm.
Janelle, she very much talks about her culture a lot and her culture being from Jamaica and being a black woman and that kind of thing. And she also has a very good volume about her. As JB puts it, she brings the fire.
Okay.
She is very much the furnace of the group. And if you listen to her poems as well, you will definitely feel it. And she does, she'll look you in the eye as she's saying these things. It's like, you cannot miss it at all.
All right.
And then the captain of our team is Brandon Williamson. He's been doing this for, I think he said, 12 years now. So he's very much a veteran in this game. And all of his poems there, he comes with that same kind of slam poet energy. And it's really cool to see his process and just see him perform. And I think a lot of us, all of us, kind of learn from him and follow his lead when it comes to doing the slam poetry thing. So we all have our strengths in the team, and we're all trying to figure out how we can put this together and really strategize and how we can make this a good experience when we go down there. And like we said, we're not so much going down there looking or expecting to win. We're down there to get a good experience, network, and really show our stuff and put Buffalo, make sure people know what the artists are in Buffalo, and really just get that experience, that good competition, and better ourselves and improve ourselves and hopefully come away inspired. Like, all right, I need to keep writing so I can come back next year and place even higher and show up.
We're talking with Dallas Taylor on What's Next. Dallas is one of the team members, the Buffalo team, that's going down to the Southern Fried Poetry Slam. So we're having a little conversation about slam poetry. And so you talked about the strengths. And you kind of said the team approach, the idea is we want to go down there, we want to make a good impression. But at the same time, is there a strategy in the way teams approach this? How do you understand that?
From what I've come to understand, where you really, when you get down there, you're really reading the audience. Because like we talked about before, the judges are picked at random.
Okay. Now, even in this case.
In this case, yeah.
All right.
So you can go down there. You have your poems planned out. It's like, all right, JB, you're going to have this poem to start out with. And then Janelle and Jamila, for the next bout, we're going to do this team piece. But then you can go in there and you see that the team that went before you, or the person that went before you, they may have a poem that has the same topic as JB. It's like, all right, we need to pull an audible. All right, now we're going to switch it around. Maybe Dallas, you'll come into this spot with one of your poems, and we'll do that.
Okay.
Or there could be a moment where you see who the judges are, because you can't see who the judges are. They're not mysterious.
Right.
It's like, all right. And you see how they've been judging some of the poems. Like, all right, they've been judging love poems this way. Maybe they don't want to hear any love poems right now. All right, so Dallas, you have to take a back seat. They don't want to hear any love poems today. So maybe they'll pull me out and have JB do something here or have Brandon do something here. So it's really just reading the room strategy-wise. You can have a plan going into it. And especially for those who have been there before, like Janelle, JB, and Brandon, who they know who some of the other teams are, so they know some of the other strengths of the other poets. Like, all right, so if we have this person going ahead of us, they really know how to, like, they know how to bring it. So we're going to have someone who's following them. You're going to have to match their energy. So maybe that's JB, maybe that's Janelle or Brandon, even Jamila. Like, all right, they coming in with this energy. You're going to have to come in and match that. But you can also just play around with it, I guess, just based on the judges, based on the room, and based on the competition as well. So it's all just just kind of go in there and feel it out. Mm-hmm. Always have a plan,
okay,
but then always have a backup plan as well.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And so I know we're about a week out from the Southern Fried Poetry Slam down in Florida, but I also know that you guys have been practicing with each other and talking about just that, which poems are going to be used. Curious about how that comes about. Is it one person's decision? Is it a group decision? Do you have to kind of fight it out a little bit? How have you come to the determination of which set of poems you might end up using?
So we each came in with maybe our top four individual poems. Like, all right, what are your four poems that are like, those are your go-tos, those are your hits.
All right.
And we go in for, we've known this for the past couple of weeks or so, we go in, practice those, and see how we can get those better as far as performance-wise. So one activity that we do is, it's called an extreme through. So in this case, you have your way that you perform your poem, but then for an extreme through, every single line, make it big, make it extreme.
Mm.
And it doesn't always mean making it just being louder. It also means maybe you're putting more emphasis on words, or you're just being very over dramatic with it, to the point where you should feel exhausted after doing it.
Okay. Do you feel exhausted after you try though? After you go do it that way?
Okay. A little bit, yeah. And you should also feel a little bit uncomfortable or weird because you're saying the lines and you're really putting a lot of drama into it. You're putting just a lot of extra energy into it just to see, all right, how big can you make this? And if we can bring it down from there. Like, I've always heard directors say during rehearsals, act as if you were on stage and make it big. So that way I know it's easier to pull you back than to bring more out of you.
All right, all right.
So extreme through it to see, all right, how big can you go? So that way I don't have to try to get more out of you. And it's much easier to just, all right, I like that, bring it down a tad bit. But that energy that you had there was great. So we practice those kind of things to really get our individual pieces ready to go and ready for competition. And then we come together and create some team pieces, whether it's two people or three people, where we're both on stage and maybe I'll have some lines here, they'll have some lines here, we'll have some lines we say in unison, there's a little bit of a back and forth, there's some more performances, like we'll switch spots, there's a lot of movement, so we'll do some choreography for those and just really working on those as well. So we have those, and then we come together, and it is as a team where we talk about, all right, so these are your top two. We'll keep those and keep the other two as like a backup, but your top two, we're definitely going to bring those and add that into our whole strategy and strategize how we can best use those to our advantage. So I think about total, there's about maybe 10 or 12 poems that we have that are like, all right, these are definitely in the playbook. Like, these are the first 10 plays that we're running.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
But also be ready to get ready to pull an audible if needed.
I was going to ask about when it comes to slam poetry. It sounds like it's a lot of fun to watch. Is it more fun to watch or to perform?
I would say it's, for me, it's a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're watching, it's like, all right, I can, not only, I can do that, but also it's, ooh, I want to do something like that.
Okay.
Like, you hear something like, ooh, maybe I can write something based off of that. But then performing it, it's nice to see the reactions from people, from the audience. And the way we like to do it at Puring Poetry, at those poetry slams where we want the audience to engage, like we want them to react, like make noise. If you hear something good, snap your fingers, stomp your feet, give like a guttural noise, mm-hmm. or like talk back to us, like, go in, poet, like speak the truth, poet. Like, we love to hear that because it gives us energy and then we can give back energy. And it's a really good experience on both sides where you're listening to like, oh, that, like, I like what you said, that hit me. And then as a poet, that feels good where you can say a line that you know is going to make them feel something, and then you get that reaction you're looking for. It's a lot of fun, and it feels really good.
Well, if you wouldn't mind, perhaps you could share one more poem with us that may or may not be making its way down to the Southern Fried Poetry Slam.
Absolutely. I love you. What do you mean when you say, I love you? I love you. Break it down, starting with I. I. The man with a... how's it go? The man whose self-confidence once grew slower than a chia pet in a dust storm. I. A man who is always so familiar with second place because he's always put others first. A man who is always concerned about pleasing others. A man who is always so concerned about what others thought of him only to realize that they didn't, because you don't think twice when you're stomping the dirt from your feet on the doormat. I. A man whose fear of failure is so strong that it often debilitates him into inaction. I. A man who, despite all that, realizes that those things could make him hate himself, but instead he chose to accept the things that he can't change and change the things that he could, because he loved himself enough to know that broken things can be fixed if you love them enough to fix them. Which brings us to love. A four-letter word that is so subjective to so many people, and that can mean so many things to so many different people. Love. Something that is so intangible that those who believe in it can see it, and those that don't only realize they had it until it is taken away. Love. Something that is so personal yet so universal that when its true essence is brought to life, there is not a single soul who could look at it and not call it by its name. Love. One of the very few infinite resources where when you give some of yours to someone else, you both have more. Love, which then brings us to you. Now, in the sentence, I love you, grammar says that you is an object. But here's the rub. For you are not an object to love, but to love you is my objective. So I love you is not only a statement of fact, it is now my mission. But let's flip that mission from I love you into you love I. Grammar comes back to say that I must change to me, because I is used when you are doing the acting and me is used when an action is done to you. All is that to say, I love you cannot be reciprocal unless you love me. Now, from the top, I emphasized I four times. I emphasized love four times, but I only emphasized you once. Because I come in many different forms, and love can be expressed in many different ways. But for me, to love you is my only objective.
You'll get a bigger hand than that at the Southern Fried Poetry Slam, I'm sure. Dallas Taylor, again, the shout-outs perhaps to your teammates from Buffalo that are going under the guise of Puring Poetry, right?
Yes, absolutely. Shout out to Brandon, our fearless leader, JB, our second leader, and Janelle and Jamila, who have been absolutely great teammates to me as I'm coming onto this team to really go down there and have a good time and really show Pompano Beach what Buffalo is all about in the poetry scene.
You go do it. Dallas Taylor, thanks for sharing with us.
Thank you.
This has been What's Next on WBFO.